And we are in Ruth chapter 4 tonight, arriving at the last chapter in this book. And I will read the first 12 verses of Ruth chapter 4, verses 1 to 12. Now Boaz had gone up to the gate and sat down there. And behold, the Redeemer of whom Boaz had spoken came by. So Boaz said, "Turn aside, friend, and sit down here." Now that's actually a place where there's a great difficulty in the Hebrew text here, in that there's just a strange, very, very strange phrase thrown in. And "turn aside, friend," is really no translation of it at all. We'll get into this a little bit more. But all it really says in the Hebrew text is a certain someone came by. Well, you got to think about that. We know who it is. It's this Redeemer, and we also know that Boaz knows this person because he was able to talk to Ruth about him. So the question is, why in the world would the narrator of the book of Ruth simply refer to him as a certain someone in the Hebrew text? So we'll come back to that, but that's... It's not a friend. It's much more ambiguous than that, and it's much more loaded than that. What is there? Something going on here as this person is introduced. So he turned aside and he sat down, and he took 10 men, that is Boaz, took 10 men of the elders of the city, and he said, "Sit down here." And they sat down, and he said to the Redeemer, "Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, is selling the parcel of land that belonged to our relative Elimelech. So I thought I would tell you of it and say, buy it in the presence of those sitting here and in the presence of the elders of the people. And if you will redeem it, redeem it. But if you will not, tell me, that I may know, for there is no one besides you to redeem it, and I come after you." And he said, "I'll redeem it." Then Boaz said, "The day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you will also acquire Ruth, the Moabite." Actually, again, the Hebrew text doesn't read that way. And here they have a note to it. The Hebrew text reads, you'll buy this field from Naomi and Ruth, which would be sort of an odd thing to say, but that's precisely what the Hebrew text says. There's no doubt about that one, the Moabite, the widow of the dead, in order that you may perpetuate the name of the dead and his inheritance. And then the Redeemer said, "I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I impair my own inheritance. Take my right of redemption yourself, for I cannot redeem it." Now, this was the custom in former times in Israel concerning redeeming and exchanging, to confirm a transaction, that one drew off his sandal and gave it to the other. And this was the manner of attesting in Israel. So when the Redeemer said to Boaz, "Buy it for yourself," he drew off his sandal. Then Boaz said to the elders and all the people, "You are witnesses this day that I have bought from the hand of Naomi all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Chilion, and to Mahlon. Also Ruth, the Moabite, the widow of Mahlon, I have bought to be my wife. perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance, that the name of the dead may not be cut off from among the brothers and from the gate of his native place. You are witnesses this day. Then all the people who were at the gate and the elders said, "We are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel. May you act worthily in Ephrathah and be renowned in Bethlehem, and may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah, because of the offspring that the Lord will give you by this young woman." There's actually a lot going on there, especially as you get near the end. And by the time we get there, I'm sure we won't have all that much time to deal with it, but we'll do our best. As you sort of come near the end of Ruth, I just remind you that this is, you know, narrative theology. The entire Old Testament is primarily, fundamentally, and at its essence, a theological book. And yet, if you would have come to faith later in life, I'm sure that if you just started reading the Bible, you would be surprised, as a friend was, actually a couple in a first church I served down in rural Iowa, who came to faith in their early 30s, and the wife started reading the Bible, and she was, husband told me that she called to him and said, his nickname was T, she said, "T, it's all a bunch of stories." She started in Genesis. It's like just one story after the next. The Bible is stories. Well, it's more than stories, but there's a lot of stories. And in the book of Ruth, there's just a story. That's pretty much all it is. It's a story with a couple of asides related to the genealogy. So, well, that's a strange way to learn theology, isn't it, by story? No, it's not a strange way to learn theology. It's probably the most powerful way to learn theology. And unfortunately, it's also about the most powerful way to learn secularism, which is how we've become so secular. The rise of multimedia, there's nobody who's seen or heard more stories acted out in their presence than you in the history of the world here in the Western world. We tune in to story after story after story, and every single one of those stories is of a theological nature. That is, they are all told, whether the author means to or not, from a theological perspective with a theological backdrop. If you don't believe me, just think of, for those of you who are readers, just think of a famous old novel, 1813, Pride and Prejudice. Jane Austen. Jane Austen is not the biggest fan of the Christian gospel or the biggest fan of the church. However, she was raised in England in her own time frame, and she absorbed a vast amount of biblical worldview. And so when you read Pride and Prejudice, how serious a thing is sex outside of the marriage bond in Pride and Prejudice? It's massive. If it takes place, it's ruinous to the entire family. It's a scandal. It's huge. It's disaster. 1813. Fast forward, 2016. Novel probably a few have read, though some of you have. It's on the New York Times bestseller list for a number of weeks. Amor Towles, a gentleman in Moscow. Novel about a guy that's swept up in the Russian Revolution. He was an aristocrat, and he is, for the rest of his life, assigned to the Metropole Hotel in Moscow, where he lives out the rest of his days. Well, in this novel, sexual relationships outside of marriage are celebrated. There is no moral element attached to it whatsoever, because Amor Towles writes completely from a postmodern perspective. And in a postmodern perspective, such that we live, such that almost all of our television shows come from now, there really is no such thing as a sexual ethic. And every story that you tune into and listen to, though we're not usually even aware of it, that fact is drummed home again and again and again and again and again, until without really even realizing it, you begin to absorb that way of thinking yourself. Story is of massive theological power. And they all carry theological significance with them. That's why there are so many stories in the Bible, because they carry theological power. And they tell you and teach you how to think about the flow of your own life in specifically theological ways. Now, as we've said repeatedly as we've gone through the book of Ruth, you know, the theological backdrop of the book of Ruth is not just that there's God, but it's the God of the first five books of Moses, and if you want to particularize it even more than that, it's the God of the book of Deuteronomy. Old Testament scholars refer to from Joshua through 2 Kings to be the Deuteronomic history. That is, all of those books in their storytelling. Assume that you know what's written in the book of Deuteronomy, and all of the judgments that are made with that very specific divinely revealed background. And that's how you can tell what's going on and who's moving in a good direction and who's moving in a disastrous direction, is by what is written there. It's the theological backdrop. Well, we'll start to look at how that works again as we turn the last, sort of going into the final turn of this story. And a couple of these are just quick stops along the way. But number one, verse one, first half of it, this is a story with historical geography in it. Now, we're being told something about just that, the geography of the place. Now, Boaz had gone up to the gate. That is, all these towns, if they were a walled city, and this is a walled city, you build them on top of the hill. That gives you the maximum self-defense capability. So if you're going to build a walled city, you don't build it in the valley. You don't build it halfway up the hill. You build it on the top of the hill. And hence, he's telling us. He's going up. You go up to the gate of the city. Why? Because the city's always built on the top of a hill. So up he goes, and he lands there at the city gate. Well, the city gate is not just where you enter the city, it's where the guards hang out, but far more than that, it's where all of the major business would be conducted in the city. You conduct it right in the city gate using these little cubby holes that were usually built into the city gate where guards would spend the night as meeting rooms. And so what Boaz has done is he's gone up to the city. He's gone to the gate, and he has sequestered one of these meeting rooms because he is about to call a meeting together. Now, second thing, very, very quickly that you notice here, and it doesn't come out very well in the, again, in the English text, but it's bold as brass in the Hebrew text. This is a story with a spiritual geography, a really, really key word here in the book of Ruth. It was a key word back in chapter 3, you remember, when in the middle of the night, Boaz rolls over because he's gotten cold, and there is a young woman laying next to him. And what he said was, "Behold, a young woman is laying next to me." So there's the behold as a surprise. And I mentioned when we went by that's linked back to the reaction of Jacob when he thinks he's just married Rachel and he wakes up in the morning and behold, it's Leah. See, this was a negative surprise for him, and a great argument for not having excessive drunkenness on your wedding night, where the wife can be switched out while you're incapacitated by alcohol. Now here, it's right there in the very first verse. And Boaz went up to the gate, and he sat there. And now here, behold, the one redeeming was passing by. Now, again, if you are an American person reading the book of Ruth and you basically have an Enlightenment view of the world, what you will say at this point is, wow, wasn't that lucky? But if the book of Deuteronomy and if the Bible is the backdrop, if the first five books of Moses are the backdrop, and he goes to the city gate and he no sooner sits down and behold, the one person in the whole town that he really needs to see just happens to be passing by. He's letting us know it wasn't just happening to pass by. So God is involved. God is involved. One of the most popular television shows of the last 14, 15 years, I don't even know what it is anymore. My wife used to really like to watch it. NCIS, Leroy Jethro Gibbs, doesn't believe in coincidences. The author of the book of Ruth doesn't believe in coincidences either. Believes in providence. So behold, the very guy that he needs to see. But now we come back to our translation issue here. For behold, the one redeeming was passing by, and Boaz said to him, "Turn aside, sit here, you certain someone." What? "You certain someone." And he turned aside and he sat. Doesn't call him by name. "You certain someone." So what in the world is going on there? Dan Block, who was here for our men's conference, a very, very, very excellent Old Testament scholar, and he's written two commentaries in the book of Ruth, actually, and he says that this little phrase, "you certain someone," as it exists here, would be a way of reflecting on somebody negatively without doing in particular. So you would say something like, "And the Redeemer came by, you know, Joe Schmo." So you don't think terribly highly of him. Joe Schmo. guy that I worked for when I was at the Moody Bible Institute in Chicago, and we were in an apartment complex, but then he kind of was moving up in the world, and so he opened a restaurant on Rush Street, sort of a nightclub sort of place. And in the day that it was supposed to open, you know, all of these friends brought all kinds of flowers to it. Well, if your flowers cost less than $100, he was insulted, and they went straight to the garbage, referred to as those mojo flowers. Mojo people bring those mojo flowers straight out the back door, absolutely insulted. I'm a big-time person. This is a big-time restaurant. You spend big-time money on flowers. Bill was truly one of the shallowest men on the planet. But that's how he thought. That's how he thought. That's how he operated. And so his term was mojo. And so you could, this mojo guy comes along. So we now know something about this guy, though. That is, Boaz does not have a massively high opinion of the guy who's in front of him in line. And so, since he cares about Ruth, the last thing in the world that he wants to see happen is for Joe Schmo here to end up with this property and with Ruth. And so he launches into our third thing. This is a story with some not only social geography and some spiritual geography and some historical geography, but also now some logical geography. Several of you mentioned a few weeks ago, you know, you wondered, what in the world? You know, so Boaz almost certainly couldn't get back to sleep at night, right? When he wakes up, there's a young woman laying next to him. Well, behold, it's Ruth. She proposes marriage to him. All kinds of questions, right? He's a lot older than her. Has he never married? His wife died? All the evidence we have, he doesn't have any other wife. We don't really know. But I can guarantee you what had never happened to him before is that a young Moabite woman had never laid down beside him in the middle of the night and proposed marriage to him. That had never happened before. And so I think he certainly didn't go back to sleep. So what's he doing? Well, I think we find out what he was thinking about all night right here. He's thinking about the strategy to take with this other redeemer. This guy that he doesn't have any respect for at all. This Joe Schmo. And here is his strategy as we find it. Here's what he does. He decides, this guy, I'm going to present it the first time around as if I'm simply bringing him an opportunity to make some easy money. You know, buy some land at a good price. This is like buying land. It was very when I moved out to Iowa in the early mid 1980s, the farm crisis was on. This was a good time to be buying land. This was a controversial time to be buying land because what was happening was the age-old thing. The rich were all about to get richer. That is, the well-heeled, well-established farmers who already own their land, they have cash hanging around. And their neighbors can no longer afford to pay the taxes on their land and put another crop in the ground, and so they are forced to put it up for auction. Their bank is forcing them to put it up for auction. So you go to the sale and you buy your neighbor's land. Those were very somber places and somber fence rows. Well, this was going on. Well, Naomi is deep into that category. Remember, they got so far into debt that they simply fled the country. So she really owns, she's probably going to get nothing from the sale of this land, but she's got to sell it. She's got to get that taken care of because she has no possible way to hold on to it. So he announces to her, "Oh, this is, I just wanted to let you know, because you've got the right to buy it before I do, that you're up. And so what do you think?" And he told, "Oh, yeah, sold, sold." And then he lets the other foot drop. "Oh, well, wonderful, wonderful. Did I mention that Naomi and Ruth own the land, and Ruth kind of comes with the deal, and of course you will want to, as a good Israelite, Deuteronomy chapter 25, 1 to 10, you will want to raise up, the only reason that you have the opportunity to buy this land ahead of me is your closer relative. That's what gives you your opportunity. Now, being the closer relative, you also have the obligation to, if you can, which you can, raise up an heir for Elimelech, who passed away, and his two sons who have passed away. And so, of course, you'll marry Ruth, and then hopefully she'll bear a son, and then eventually the land will be his. He'll be the heir. And Joe Schmo says, actually, I don't think I can afford to buy the land. Nope, just checked. Nope, there's no way. Couldn't possibly buy the land. And that's, you're supposed to see. See, this is where Boaz is staying. Bingo. That's what he hoped. That's what he laid up thinking about. How to present this in such a way that it will seem monstrous. Now, it wasn't terribly difficult, probably, she's not even a Jewish girl. This Israelite had married a Moabite. Yeah, you got to marry a Moabite. Ruth, the Moabite. Not a lot of Israelites were keen on cross-cultural marriage. So he had that, Boaz has that in his favor, because he's apparently wide open to it. But that's what he does. And that's how it falls out. But then finally, this really strange thing happens when he gets his way, and it's all great. Then the narrator comes back with this. After they do the whole shoe thing, and we'll just pass over that. Remember, this is the days in which there's no king in Israel, and everybody does what's right in their own eyes. And so the actual text of how it works out in Deuteronomy probably hasn't been practiced in detail for a long time. So this guy gets to forbear the thing with the shoe, of course, is you actually take your shoe off, and then the woman in question, so Ruth, would come and spit in his face in Deuteronomy 25 through his unwillingness to raise up an offspring. But it usually would be a brother's face, because the closest relative would be that close. Here, they're extrapolating out. There is no brother. The brothers are both dead. This is simply the closest relative, but that's part of the whole shoe thing in the book of Deuteronomy, as you take the shoe off, and then she stands up and spits in your face, and the elders view all of this, and then you're released, and you don't have to marry the woman. Well, here they just pull the shoe off as part of that, and so give it a nod sort of in that direction. But then notice what it says at the end there. The two surprising things, and we'll just close off on this, and this is what all of a sudden starts to tie it to the close of the book. We are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel. And the question is, why would Rachel be mentioned first? Why would Rachel be mentioned first? Boaz isn't a descendant of Rachel. He's a descendant of Leah. Because he's a descendant of Judah. And Judah is Leah's son. And Leah was the first wife. She provided the most kids. So why mention Rachel first? Well, pretty simple. Rachel had a great deal of trouble conceiving. Years and years and years and years. What they know about Ruth for sure is Ruth has been married 10 years and never been able to have a child. That's ominous. That's ominous. That was the great heartache of Rachel's life. And hence they slide Rachel forward and say, and we're hoping that you will have the blessing of Rachel on you. But then, apparently showing no propriety at all, at least that's how it would seem to us, is now you switch over and may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah. Well, you talk about an embarrassing family mess to get back into. Remember the story of Tamar and Judah. Tamar's husband dies. Judah promises her. Well, she's actually had a few husbands die. There's a pattern going on. If you marry her, you die, is what it looks like. And so Judah promises her, don't worry, gonna find you a husband very soon. Very soon. But he has no intention of doing that, and Tamar eventually figures that out and then poses as a prostitute, you will remember, along the road at shearing time. And then and Judah goes in unto her, and she conceives from Judah. And just before he has her executed for philandering sexually on his dead sons, she brings forth the evidence that she very shrewdly pulled off of him in the process and presents it to him. And at least Judah does have just enough decency not to kill her and cover it up. Instead, he repents. But what, like, wow, what is going on here? Well, this is even more to the case, though. The very thing Judah didn't do is find a kinsman redeemer for Tamar. Now, this is before the law is written, so there's no Deuteronomy 25 here, but it's already a custom in Israel, clearly. And he doesn't do it. He doesn't do it. But Tamar sees to it and ends up with Perez and a twin. But Perez, of course, shows up in the genealogy of David and shows up in Matthew 1 in the genealogy of Jesus. And Ruth, in that genealogy, shows up as one of the messy women, right? The three women mentioned in Jesus' genealogy, it's all messy. It's Rahab. Well, in order, it's Tamar, Rahab, and Ruth. Prostitute, somebody posing as a prostitute, and a foreign girl who proposed marriage to a Jewish man in the middle of the night, lying next to him. Scandal, scandal, and scandal. The Lion of Christ. We'll come back to this more greater lake next week. But you ever look out at your life and think, too messy. God will never be able to really use somebody like me. Just made too many mistakes too early on. Too much baggage. Made too many dumb decisions. Too much trouble. Well, the Bible argues strongly against that. Strongly against that. Of all the situations that are paused on in Jesus' genealogy, as the only ones that are paused on are the messy ones. Where the three women involved are named off, reminding you, this was a mess. This looked hopeless. Yes, it did. Which is meant to be tremendously comforting. So at the very moment when you may think, no, I don't think Jesus could ever use somebody who's made the mistakes, who's had the trouble, who's whatever it is that I have, the Bible rises up and says, would you just read the text? That's nonsense. That's utter nonsense. That isn't the way of God. He has a great history of using people who have been in very messy situations, who have had their reputations absolutely destroyed. I mean, Tamar comes this close to being stoned to death for sexual indiscretion. And there she is, in the genealogy of Jesus, front and center. Should encourage us all. We'll close in prayer. We not only have to pick up chairs tonight, but if a few of you could catch up with John Massa afterwards, we also have to set up for voting across the way, and John has a little map of that room, and so he can help you help him set up over there. So if some would pick up here, and then a couple others would go find John, and he'll help you help him set up the room for voting on Tuesday. Let's close in prayer, and then we'll sing our final hymn. Father in heaven, we thank you for gathering us around this story, and may we have our story lining up in our minds and thought of in categories much more like the Book of Ruth than a gentleman in Moscow, than the average episode that we watch on television or the average movie that we see on Netflix or watch in the theater. May our view of our own life be shaped by the stories that you have told about how central you are to the story of our life and experience. We ask for this in Jesus' name. Amen.